we can see that illuminated sign that marks the end of the journey.
This vaccine will help us get past this pandemic once and for all.
We need people to have faith that this vaccine is safe and that they should take it. The thing that's going to stop us from seeing the end of this pandemic are people going, oh, I'm not so sure.
Hello, you're listening to Bloomberg Westminster, your daily guide to British politics. I'm Roger Hearing.
And a very good afternoon. I'm Caroline Hepke. Now, we start with the big news this morning that the Football Super League has imploded. Within 48 hours, effectively, of being announced, it seems, the six English clubs that signed up, Manchester City, Chelsea, Manchester United, Arsenal, Tottenham Hotspurs and Liverpool, well, they fell like dominoes after the backlash from fans, politicians and players.
Well, Reuters has reported that Juventus chairman Andrea Agnelli says the breakaway tournament can no longer go ahead. Here, the Culture Secretary Oliver Dowden called the collapse a victory for fans. So how did the Super League fail so spectacularly? Well, we spoke yesterday to Greg Dyke, former chairman of the Football Association, and even then he said the idea was destined to fail.
Well, I think the reaction over the last couple of days has been so strong against it. I don't think they expected anything like the reaction they've had, certainly in the UK. But I have yet to meet or hear or find anybody who supports it.
So that was Greg Dyke. Well, the organisers of the Super League now say that they plan to, quote, reshape the project. But the spectacular own goal has some calling for more regulation of the beautiful game and who gets to own the teams. We're going to discuss a bit later on the programme a bit more about the Super League with Bloomberg opinion columnist Therese Raphael.
But today we're going to move our focus on to Northern Ireland. In about 10 days, the province will be marking its centenary. Now, it comes amid violent clashes in loyalist areas recently following frustration over the customs border in the Irish Sea and feelings that the province is slowly breaking away from the UK. Well, according to a new poll commissioned by the BBC, a majority of people on both sides of the Irish border now believe Northern Ireland will have left the UK within 25 years. Joining us now, I'm very pleased to say, is Declan Kearney, who's national chairperson for Sinn Féin, a member of the Assembly and also a junior minister. Thanks for being with us today, Declan. Welcome to the programme. Another poll, in fact, caught my eye this morning, reported by RTE in Dublin, suggesting a majority of people in the Republic don't expect a United Ireland anytime soon. So where do you think the argument on all this is now?
I think what all of this reflects is the extent to which a very dynamic conversation is taking place across the island of Ireland about the inevitability of constitutional change. And as a result, the responsibility on political leaders and on both the British and Irish governments now is to ensure that we put in place a process which allows for an orderly transition from the current status quo towards Irish reunification. And the provision exists within the Good Friday Agreement for the triggering of a unity referendum. Concurrent referenda, North and South. Sinn Féin is arguing that we have now arrived at the point when we should be setting a date for the unity referenda, North and South. And on the basis of winning the unity referenda, giving people the opportunity to have their say, and we believe increasingly numbers of citizens, North and South, are recognising that their future is best served in a constitutional, new constitutional setup on the island of Ireland, that we begin the transition, an orderly transition, from the current status quo, an end to partition, and the establishment of a new constitutional national democracy on the island of Ireland.
But on the basis of the polling that Roger just mentioned, you could lose on this evidence, at least.
Well, I think we have to come at the issue of polls in a very sensible way. They represent moments in time. What is unquestionable is that the effect of Brexit has changed the political landscape in Ireland. There is now a discussion taking place that in my lifetime is unprecedented about how we can in fact shape a new constitutional future for all of our people. And therefore, what we need to do, I believe, is learn the lessons of how not to conduct referenda. And the failure of the Brexit referendum in Britain is a case in point, where there was a catastrophic approach taken towards managing the debate. Sinn Féin's arguing for a very informed, inclusive national conversation about how, in fact, we can introduce constitutional change on our island, recognising that in the first instance, we need to have an informed discussion. We then need to have the referenda. And then we need to work out the modalities that are required to allow for the transition which I speak about.
Yeah. But Declan, I mean, you only had to look at what was going on the streets of Belfast just a week or two back. You see the passion, the anger that was clearly there. The DUP has been channeling this to some extent. You've accused them of reckless behaviour and political vandalism against the Good Friday Agreement, but they are channeling a mood that's clearly there in the loyalist community who don't want what you're talking about and feel very, very threatened. You can't easily reconcile them, can you?
I disagree with your premise. I do believe that the DUP and other sections of political unionism have been involved in a very serious form of zero-sum politics. It's dead-end politics, you might say. And they have whipped up an hysteria within some sections of the unionist section of our community. But I don't believe for a moment that that is representative of wider unionist opinion. The fact is that Brexit has now prompted many people to review the current political circumstances that we find ourselves living in. They recognise that Brexit has changed everything. The poll which was broadcast last night actually indicated that a majority of people in the north of Ireland under the ages of 45 actually envisage their future in the United Ireland. 50% of under 45-year-olds would prefer to see Irish reunification than not. So I think we have a picture of many moving parts at this particular point in time. But what has happened in the streets of Belfast over the course of the last 3 weeks, I think does need to be set in context with the failure of leadership being exhibited by the Democratic Unionist Party and other sections of political unionism. They've allowed the extremists to basically set the agenda for them. They're responding to the extremist agenda. It's important, I think, for your listeners to bear in mind that at the beginning of the year, a Lucid poll suggested that in the next assembly election, which is scheduled for May 2022, the Democratic Unionist Party could in fact lose support to the extremist edges of political unionism. And I think that's a major dynamic in relation to the approach that the DUP have taken to politics in the north of Ireland over the course of the last period of months.
Okay, you mention Brexit. Is there a way to sort out the protocol, the Northern Ireland protocol, with the EU? How could it work?
Yes, I do believe that with goodwill and appropriate political leadership, these are issues that can be addressed by both the British government and the European Commission. And I would point you towards the remarks by the European Commission Vice President Maroš Šefčovič, who spoke in the last 24 hours, where he acknowledged the need to minimise disruption being caused by the protocol. But he also made the point that this is a two-way street. He accepts, and I believe, that checks can be made smoother. And a lot of the controls that currently are required as a result of the protocol having been negotiated. And let's remember, the protocol is an integral part of the withdrawal agreement, which was negotiated by the English government, by the British government, with eyes wide open. Yeah. So they negotiated these terms. And the European Commission are indicating that several of these controls which currently apply could in fact be removed if solutions can be found with goodwill by the British government and the European Commission in relation to how we get agreement on standards concerning food protection, phytosanitary controls and other measures. And that's all about food safety, public health and animal welfare.
Yeah, Declan, let me ask you about something which I think is absolutely crucial to any part of this going forward, which is trust. clearly there was no trust effectively between the communities visible in Belfast in the last few weeks, nor trust, I think, between yourselves and the DUP. And that isn't helped when it seems that the authorities, the police in this instance, treated a group of Sinn Féiners who'd gone to a funeral in breaching lockdown regulation. No action was taken against them. This makes a lot of people think it's one law for one law for others. Suggest double standards. That doesn't help.
I don't accept that premise at all. Let's remember that the PPS received a file from the PSNA, and then the PPS arrived at a determination. Now, it's also important to bear in mind, and I say this effectively from a sub judice perspective, that there is now a review being carried out by HMIC in relation to the PSNA approach to that particular matter. And there is a review being undertaken by our PPS in relation to that decision. So there are a number of issues extant. But policing is very challenging in the north of Ireland. It's a characteristic of our conflict resolution process. But I don't accept that it is acceptable politics on behalf of senior DUP politicians and ministers in government to call for the resignation of senior police officers when they receive decisions that they don't like. That's more of the dead-end politics which I spoke about. And we do need to have trust, but trust is a two-way street. It needs to be built. But most important of all, and I think this goes to the very heart of our discussion this morning, we need to see implementation of the Good Friday Agreement. It was signed off on 23 years ago, and 23 years on, we still have to see fundamental elements of the Good Friday Agreement properly implemented by the British government.
Now let's have a look at what else is making news in the world of politics. And we begin, Caroline, with the virus.
Yeah, indeed. Boris Johnson says that Britain must be ready for another wave of the coronavirus later this year. The Prime Minister is still insisting, of course, that the plans to end social restrictions by, the 21st of June are on track. But he's warning that COVID is going to stay around for some time to come.
The majority of scientific opinion in this country is still firmly of the view that there will be another wave of COVID at some stage this year. And so we must, as far as possible, learn to live with this disease as we live with other diseases.
So COVID cases in the UK have been falling pretty dramatically since January, but there are still a lot of concerns, Roger, about new variants that could knock the UK off course.
Well, something else that could knock the UK off course is if there's a bout of inflation. It doesn't seem to be much of one at the moment. Inflation did accelerate during the last month of lockdown, however. Consumer prices rose 0.7% from a year ago in March after a 0.4% gain the month before. Now, this adds to pressure on British people's pockets, inevitably. Research suggests UK household finances are far worse than households in either France or Germany. But businesses remain positive, with a number of UK sectors reporting output growth rising to a six-month high in March.
Meanwhile, when it comes to politics, Defence Minister Johnny Mercer has resigned. He says he was forced to leave his job over the treatment of veterans who served in Northern Ireland. Number 10 confirmed his exit actually on Tuesday ahead of the Overseas Operations Bill returning to the Commons on Wednesday. Now, this new law protects veterans from prosecutions for their actions after a certain time period. But Mercer is objecting to the fact that soldiers who served in Northern Ireland will be excluded from the bill, and Mercer called that a red line for him staying in government.
Yeah, that bill itself hugely controversial, of course, for what it does in terms of potential for the UK to be prosecuted by the International Criminal Court in the future. Meanwhile, the government has abandoned plans to hold White House-style televised briefings, despite spending £2.6 million on a new studio. Boris Johnson's press secretary, Allegra Stratton, is now going to become spokeswoman for the COP26 Climate Change Summit, which, of course, takes place later this year. For her part, she says she's delighted to be starting the role.
Mm-hmm. Right, that's a little roundup of some of the news in the world of politics. But let's also talk about an announcement that we're expecting from the Prime Minister on cutting carbon emissions even more steeply. A new target of reducing emissions by 78% by 2035 compared to 1990 levels. Now, the Prime Minister is making this commitment ahead of the US President's virtual climate summit, which starts tomorrow on Earth Day, and also ahead ahead of hosting the COP26 International Climate Change Summit here in the UK in November. Joining us now is Bloomberg Opinion columnist Therese Raphael to discuss. I mean, we've had a number of big announcements on toughening up the climate emissions rules in the UK, you know, stopping selling polluting vehicles sooner than we had thought. Do you think that this new set of goals that we're going to get from the Prime Minister is actually achievable?
Well, I think they're clearly setting out a set of goals that are intended to, for one thing, to be world-beating, to use that phrase that Boris Johnson really likes. So these are targets that, you know, are probably the most ambitious we've seen anywhere. And if you think about, you know, just a couple of years ago, or I think maybe even last year, we had environmental groups saying that, you know, even getting to a 72% reduction, would be a big achievement. So the first thing is that the setting of the goal, which is, you know, meant to be enshrined in law, which is, you know, quite, it makes it sound, you know, quite a major commitment, is intended to signal to the rest of the world that Britain is going to lead on emissions reduction and on getting to net zero. But then the question is exactly how do you get there, and how do you get there within what does legislation do that policy can't do? So bringing political targets into legislation has various consequences. So in one sense, it makes government more strategic. It signals internally to other departments that laws and policy have to be in conformity with this legislation. But, you know, the flip side of it is it could be quite an embarrassment if the targets are missed. And as you imply, there's quite a lot to get there. So there's, you know, on electric vehicles, I think we're moving in that direction quite quickly. But on other areas, such as changing heating over to getting rid of gas boilers and finding ways to heat homes that reduce the carbon footprint, you know, we're a long way from getting there, and that's going to be a big part of reaching these targets. So it's not clear how, despite putting them into legislation, the government plans to actually make that a reality. And bear in mind, the Climate Committee said this is going to cost about $50 billion a year annually. Now, some have disputed that figure, but whatever, you know, whichever way you look at it, it's a very expensive task to get there, and just creating a target, even putting it in law, doesn't sort of guarantee that we achieve it.
Well, certainly not. I mean, if I suppose the comparison is to say, OK, we say, you know, it's got to be done by 2035, pretty clear Boris Johnson won't still be in power then, or at least the assumption is that he won't. But if, for example, the commitment in law to spend a certain amount on international aid, that was exactly overturned by Parliament with some controversy, clearly these things are perhaps not much more than gestures.
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of examples of legislating for policy that doesn't go well. I mean, there was fuel poverty. Other countries have, say, fiscal targets. And, you know, one thing, of course, about the British parliamentary system is that there's parliamentary sovereignty, so the next parliament can change something. Now, there are ways that you can sort of load these legal commitments so that it makes it hard to, that the process of changing it is very onerous. But, there's always ways around it. So I think, you know, we shouldn't take these targets as, absolutely written in stone until we see a pathway to achieve them.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, just by way of example, London has exceeded national air pollution limits since 2015. The congestion charging zone in the UK, some campaigners say, has actually made pollution in the capital worse. I mean, on many measures, the UK is sort of not actually, we've got a lot of goals, but we haven't got a lot of pathways to actually get there. And I suppose when I look at the election that's about to take place in Germany in September, you know, where the Greens are sort of polling very strongly and could well be in contention for the chancellorship, you sort of wonder, the Green Party in the UK is nowhere. So it's kind of, there's no challenge particularly, I don't think, holding the Tories' feet to the fire, as it were, on this.
Yeah, I think against that, I guess I would say that the Green objective has now been pretty, you know, fully absorbed yeah. into mainstream parties. Mm-hmm. So whereas, you know, climate action would not have featured among the top, you know, top list of priorities. So now it's on at the doorstep. Politicians are hearing about it all the time. In the integrated review, it was, you know, declared as the main goal of this government, and you know obviously the Labour Party takes it very seriously as well. So I think the fact that the Greens are doing, I think, better, but it's the kind of co-option of their agenda by yeah. the mainstream parties. So it's almost a their success in a way, or at least the success of the agenda that you know means that a one issue party just really, you know, isn't that viable in UK politics.
Well, let's talk about electoral agenda, because I think one thing that's been very interesting in the story that's really dominated the beginning of this week, of course, which has been the moves towards forming a super league in football, European football, and then it's a pretty catastrophic collapse, really, within the last 24 hours. Politicians have been very forward in this, in condemning it right across the board here in the UK. And I suppose, is there a sense, someone shouldn't be too cynical, this is simply an issue where, by standing with the fans, by standing against the billionaires who own the clubs, it's completely win-win for all politicians?
Absolutely. I mean, I think there's, you know, it would be very hard in Britain to come out, you know, in favor of Super League when you saw just the groundswell of support by fans, by, you know, influencers and big personalities in football. You know, so this was an easy one for the government, let's say. It's as easy as it gets. Obviously, the Labour Party wasn't going to oppose Boris Johnson when he said he would do everything to get the Super League to rethink its plans. And now, you know, how he was going to legislate for that was unclear, but certainly there were a lot of levers the government could pull, from, you know, making quite a lot of phone calls to getting the competitions authority to look at it. And, you know, with local elections coming up, it doesn't hurt. And, you know, remember that the news of recent days has been, you know, certain Conservative Party members, including a former Prime Minister who've been in the news a lot over a lobbying scandal to do with Greensill, Lex Greensill, as we know. So, you know, anything to get that off the front page is anything to be on the side of football fans, you know, of course, yeah. Win-win.
But we do have a by-election, for example, in Hartlepool coming up. Does this actually win votes? And I wonder, this is a question about, you know, the sophistication of voters and perhaps also the allegiance of these politicians. I mean, maybe you could win votes if you really are a football fan, but people might not like it if you're not, right?
Well, I don't think it's probably what voters are going to cast their vote on, right? But it probably creates a sense of you know, at least feeling that the government is listening to you know, to sports fans, he's sort of on their side. I think the vaccination campaign has been, you know, one of the things that will win votes for Boris Johnson, and, you know, really just the lack of real cut through from Labour leader yeah. Keir Starmer. So no, I don't see the you know the Super League issue as being a decider on May 6th, but it hasn't hurt.
Bloomberg Westminster. Listen weekdays at noon on DAB Digital Radio in London.